Big Adventures with Brian Durker is supported by Dave Wegner and dedicated to all the scientists and river community who have worked to protect the Colorado River, Grand Canyon, and its environment. Thank you, Dave, for your support of Big Adventures.
Well, this is Brian Durker with Big Adventures, and I have a big adventure with a guy that's on a big adventure here sitting with me, Ed Keebles, superintendent of Grand Canyon National Park. And oh, by the way, that is our greatest national treasure. And he has a big job. And Ed, thank you so much for coming.
Sure, happy to do it, Brian.
I actually am sitting in your office, and thank you so much for that. The biggest thing that I always am interested in with somebody in your position is what your background is, or what your childhood was, or I always like to ask where you were born, and little background information. I understand you came from a big family.
Yeah, I came from a large family in the northeast corner of New York State. Grew up in a small town called Chazy, New York, on Lake Champlain, which is the nearly Great Lake that separates New York from Vermont. And the house I grew up in was about 6 miles south of the Canadian border.
Oh, way up in the North Country, yeah.
Yeah, that's what they call it, the North Country.
And do you have brothers and sisters?
I have 6 brothers and 1 sister.
Oh, that is a big family. There's only 6 in my family.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was that fun?
It was great. I had a great childhood, and one of my first messages to staff, I sort of described who I was, sort of along the lines of what you're doing, and let them know that I grew up in the outdoors, basically, as a kid. I tell the story, and I got into trouble for my mother for telling this story, that so now I'm going to do it on a podcast.
and hopefully she listens.
You know, in the summer months, we had all of our time outdoors, my siblings and I. And, you know, we had this great lilac patch.
Oh, yeah, beautiful.
Probably
beautiful trees.
An acre or so, at least in my imagination, it was an acre of lilacs. And there were these paths that we, you know, we used to play there and hide and seek and stuff. There were the paths and spent a lot of time there. And next to that, there was a grove of pines that just sort of reached up to the sky and was just covered, the floor was covered with pine needles that had decayed and was soft. And next to that was a horse paddock and was filled with wildflower. And we used to play out there and, you know, when the horses weren't there, we'd pretend we were riding horses and riding off into the sunset as cowboys.
And cool place.
We were oftentimes barefoot, you know, the whole time. And the part that I got into trouble with my mother with was I let people know that in the summertime, after breakfast, she would shoo us out of the house and say, you know, don't come into the house until lunch. And then after lunch, she would shoo us out of the house and say, don't come back till dinner. And then after dinner, she would say, she'd shoo us out of the house and say, don't come home until bedtime. And so we were just outside all the time, and the part that she got upset with is because it made it look like she was neglectful.
You know, I really identify with that because my mother was the same. She was out, and we had this place down in Sedona that she actually had a bell mounted way up in the rafters, and she'd ring this bell, and that meant come on in.
We had a triangle outside
the
back door, and she would ring the triangle and. That's how we knew it was dinner time.
That's
or
how
lunchtime.
You manage a lot of kids, I guess. those were smart women back in
right,
the day.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah. So I had to tell my mother that everybody I tell that story to loves that story because it created this great love of the outdoors.
Oh yeah.
You know, certainly the people who come to the Grand Canyon to work, they're so dedicated to this park and they have they share a love of the outdoors. So it's actually, I think, an endearing story.
Quite endearing and relevant. I mean, people, I think whether it's the park people or the people in the river community or all the backcountry people, all of us have a similar love for the outdoors. And so it's beyond endearing that somebody with your leadership would have that. Mm-hmm. And also the difference between you guys running around barefoot and my family here is there's a lot more rocks out west.
To say nothing of the scorpions.
And the scorpions and snakes and oh my, whatever else. That's great. And so then did you stay in that area like through your informative school years, like pre-high school and high school? And
essentially through college and law school. I went to college 2 hours west of where I grew up in a small town in Canton, New York, a small liberal arts college called St. Lawrence University near the St. Lawrence Seaway. And I went to law school at Vermont Law School, which is another very small town in South Royalton, uh-huh. Vermont, near to Dartmouth in New Hampshire, just across the border from Dartmouth, New Hampshire.
So
all the way through college and law school, I was reasonably close to home and spent time outdoors in all those endeavors.
Yeah, neat. And what did you enjoy school? Did you enjoy law school? Were you like a sponge for it?
I was one of the few people who just loved law school from day one. I love learning, and there was certainly a lot to learn during law school.
Oh, I can only imagine. Yeah, I had a brother go through that, and I know he put a lot into it. So after law school, you get a job, or?
So my last 2 years of college, I joined ROTC. And so I was committed to military service out of college. I got a deferment to go to law school. So after I graduated law school, I had a guaranteed job in the Army. If I passed the bar, I was going to be a JAG officer. If I didn't pass the bar, I was going to be an armor officer. So, unfortunately, I passed the bar.
Yeah, is that really, truly what the...
Yeah, if I had not passed the bar exam, I would have been assigned to the Armor Corps.
Oh, and so did you go straight in to serve? And
yes. And so,
what kind of job was that?
So it was actually a great experience. I had 4 assignments in my 7 years in the Army. I had a 4-year commitment, and I served an additional 3 because I was just enjoying it so much. And I lived on 3 continents in 4 assignments. So I served in Korea and Germany, as well as a couple of different postings in the States. And my first assignment was as a trial defense lawyer at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. And I was in court representing a defendant in an arson case the first Friday of my assignment. So I had a week to get ready for a Friday court date.
Wow, from just right into the fire.
Right into the fire. So I was trying cases right away, and it was a great experience. I am, in addition to being enjoying learning, and when you litigate, you're learning all the time too. I enjoy just the intellectual process of trying to convince people of one thing or another, and so.
Do you mind me asking? Did you win the arson?
I did not.
He did set the fire.
In the Army, a lot of cases settle. The military police do a really good job of assembling evidence, and it's hard to oftentimes contest those. There's sometimes procedural errors that you can take advantage of, but the conviction rate is fairly high because the military police are so thorough, and the judicial system is actually is really good. I did win cases, but not often, and fortunately, I became a prosecutor, and I won those cases.
And you appreciated that on the other end.
Yeah.
With that, would you be assigned to these guys, or?
Yes.
Yeah. So you were.
So I was in an office in my first posting where I was the defense counsel. There were 3 of us at Fort Leonard Wood, chief, and then 2 staff. Attorneys.
So
and
cases come in, and the chief would assign
the cases to the 2 of us, and he would take some himself.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, you don't really think about that, but there is kind of a whole contained world in that military setting, isn't there?
Right.
And then so you did that. You come out of the military, and do you go right into another job, or do you take some time, or what do you do after you leave the military? It's been your life.
Yeah, so I actually took 3 years off before I got my next job. I fell in love with somebody who had some health issues, and so I just resigned my commission and decided to spend some time taking care of him. And fortunately, he worked through those health issues, and we wound up, we've been together for 27 years.
Yeah, now. That's great. Heaven. But what a remarkable thing, having help. If you're, you know, sometimes I wonder if I were in that situation, what a lonely place that could be.
Yeah, and it was really important. I mean, so he was hospitalized a number of times, and I would just spend, I had the luxury to spend all my time in the hospital. So the nurses would just set up a cot, and I would stay there, and I was able to be his advocate in the hospital. And unfortunately, you know, you oftentimes need an advocate in a hospital.
Yeah, exactly. They're a complicated place, and especially for those long, complicated stays and stuff. I grew up in a medical family, you know, and the advocate is a very important element.
Right.
Well, good for you. That's pretty amazing. And then good for him for his health. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, fantastic story there. Now, after 3 years, he's stabilized, he's healthy, and you guys are continuing having a great life together, and you get a job. What's your next job?
So my next job was staff attorney in the Division of General Law in the Solicitor's Office, the Department of the Interior. I practiced administrative law and started giving advice on a range of issues. So basically the administrative procedure, legal interests for how to run a federal agency, appropriations and budgeting, personnel, contracts, departmental authorities, congressional oversight, a really wide range of legal issues.
So it was probably pretty interesting with the broad spectrum that I'm hearing there.
Oh, yeah. Getting back to my love of learning, I felt like I learned something every day in that job because the portfolio was so broad.
Yeah, it sounds like an education all its own.
I mean,
really, that's as big as it comes. And so you were with the solicitor's office for a good long while, right?
23 years.
Yeah, wow. Can you share any highlights of that job with us as far as looking back on that job?
Sure. Well, fairly early on, I had the privilege of giving legal advice to Secretary of the Interior and Deputy Secretaries of the Interior, and basically spent 23 years giving advice to cabinet and sub-cabinet officials, and as well as anybody else in the department. I mean, frankly, in that job, anybody in the department could have called me for legal advice. And another aspect of it was that I was and my colleagues were lawyers to the lawyers of the department. Our lawyers were either water lawyers or park lawyers or endangered species lawyers, and we had expertise in areas of law that they needed to supplement what they were giving legal advice on. And so they would come to us, for example, the Administrative Procedure Act and how to properly implement rulemaking in the federal government. That was one of our areas of practice.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Yeah.
So we became what I used to call the lawyers to the lawyers of the department, as well as to, you know, policymakers. And so in my 6 or 7 years in that staff attorney position, I got to know pretty much every lawyer in the department. And that became really helpful because in my next job, I was the associate solicitor for administration, which is the equivalent of the managing partner of the firm. So I was responsible for managing the personnel, budget, contracting, and other resources of the solicitor's office, which had 8 regional offices and 8 or 9 field offices in addition to the headquarters office. And so I had the benefit of having worked with the vast majority of the lawyers in the office. So when I took that job, which was my first executive level job, I pretty much knew everybody in the solicitor's office, and it was a great benefit.
Oh, I'll bet that was to pretty handy.
Organization. Yeah, right.
Because relationships are everything, aren't they? I mean, they
really are.
How you develop the ability to communicate, and I can see that as being huge. And so a lot of that was administration type stuff. If they wanted to go forward with something, they'd have to go through the solicitors.
Right. So I managed, like I said, I managed our budget, I managed our records, I managed our buildings, and a whole wide range of, you know, information technology.
You're with that office for 24 years, or you're doing that for 24 years. Can you share with us how you go from there to here? You're the superintendent of our greatest national treasure, Ed.
Yeah,
it's
an interesting story. So I was on a 2-month detail to Salt Lake City at the beginning of 2020, so January, February, and my husband and I were planning a ski trip to Austria, starting the 6th of March, and so I was flying from Salt Lake City to Washington to pack bags to go to Austria to ski, and
I'd love to do that myself.
So I lived in Germany for a few years, and I've skied extensively in Europe, and it's just great.
Yeah.
It's a great experience.
I've got to go do that.
Yeah. The Secretary of the Interior, David Bernhardt, found out I was going to be in town for a day, and he asked me to come visit him. And it happened to be my birthday. And I had known Secretary Bernhardt for almost 20 years as a client, as my boss in Bush 43. He was the solicitor when I was the associate for administration.
Oh, yeah.
And so I knew him well and had given him legal work. And when he came back as the deputy secretary and then the secretary, I was giving him legal advice extensively and worked with him quite a lot. And so my boss, the principal deputy solicitor, gave me a call the day before and told me that the secretary wanted to see me, and he thought that I might get asked whether or not I would be willing to become the superintendent of the Grand Canyon National Park.
Did that catch you by surprise completely?
Not completely. I mean, it was surprising, but not completely. I had known that this position had been vacant for close to 2 years, and I know that the department had advertised it a couple of times and wasn't satisfied with the candidates that had applied. So the secretary was trying to figure out how to fill this important position. And Senator McSally, every time he went to a Senate hearing, would ask him pointedly, when are you going to fill the Grand Canyon superintendency? And so, you know, when you're in this senior executive service, one of the consequences of being the senior executive service is if the Secretary of the Interior or any cabinet official asks you to take a job, your options are to say yes or to resign your position.
At the pleasure of the Secretary.
Yes,
right?
We serve at the pleasure of the Secretary, right?
It's a polite way of saying, here's what you're going to do.
exactly. I had given advice to Secretary Jewell following the what I refer to the troubles on the river, you know, how to respond to the IG report about sexual harassment, and to Director Jarvis. I'd given advice about Grand Canyon issues, and not just that, about other issues going on in the Grand Canyon, so I had some familiarity with it. So I wasn't entirely surprised when the secretary asked me, but it's good to have had 24 hours because, you know, I talked to my husband and...
Yeah, that's something you'd have to mull over, right?
Yeah. So I had a day, and so that when the secretary asked me, I immediately said yes, and because the opportunity to work in this park, to be responsible for preserving the resources and making them available to the visiting public, is, frankly, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that obviously very few people get a chance to
it's
do.
It's a noble position in my eyes, and yeah, it's a great thing that you're here. So you've been here a year and a half, 2 years almost.
Right.
So what month did you get here?
So my my start date was April 26th, 2020, and I got to the park a couple of weeks later. I spent the first 2 weeks in Washington orienting to the Park Service, you know, meeting. I mean, frankly, I already knew most of the people in the senior leadership in the Park Service because I was their lawyer.
Right.
But, you know, really learning from them what their expectations were, particularly the deputy director who was exercising the authority of the director at the time, you know, getting his charge his expectation, and the rest of the senior leadership team really understanding what their expectations were and what their needs were from the superintendent of the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, and there must have been a, you know, with the, as you mentioned, some of the past issues, there must have been some real targets that...
It was.
Almost daunting.
Sure. you know, actually, not sure. So I've managed at the executive level for 17 years before coming here, and I've dealt with all sorts of challenging situations. I've testified before Congress in heated congressional oversight hearings, and when you're a defense counsel and you're responsible for managing a case that affects somebody's life, or at least their liberty, you know, you learn early about responsibility and how to handle responsibility. So I never felt that this was a daunting experience.
Yeah,
it's certainly a really challenging job. There are real challenges that this park is working through, but I feel really well qualified to do it, and I very quickly learned and understood this was likely to be the case, and was thrilled to find out that it was the case, that there is just a really great team of super dedicated, super talented people here who love this place, and many of whom are committing their lives to it. I mean, your wife, one of them.
Yeah, and we could name off a bunch of them.
Oh, sure.
I've been here. I've always just loved the dedication of the troop park employee, ranger, or interpretive, or all the way down the line, archaeologists. So whatever they do, they're here for a little more special reason than people realize.
Right.
You do have a great bunch here.
Yeah.
I'd like to jump into a little big adventure that you and I shared.
Sure.
In March, was your first river trip, and I was lucky enough to be on it. It was a four-boat archaeological trip for Jen, and she was monitoring her sites and stuff like that. And it also happened to be that they were doing stuff up at Glen Canyon Dam and cut the water off for 5 days down to 4,000 cubic feet per second, which it was when we were running the gorge, right? I mean, so we were down there in really unusual terms, but share with me your impression of your first experience down there. It was an amazing trip. It was truly an adventure.
Yeah, no, it was an amazing trip. Starting out with John Gregory and our river operations staff drove me to Lease Ferry. And we drove to Lease Ferry in a blinding blizzard.
Right.
you remember when we loaded the boats, it was still snowing.
It was still snowing.
And so my first experience on the Colorado River was in a snowstorm.
Which is rare.
Yeah. And a great experience. I mean, I grew up on the Canadian border, so...
You didn't seem too daunted by that either.
Yeah, right. I love the outdoors. I love weather, so
the extremes are really good to be involved with.
I used to run at lunchtime in Washington, and my favorite running weather was 95 degrees, 95% humidity, and so I just
embrace the extreme.
It's exactly right. And actually, at the end of the trip, I regularly do, I wrote an email to staff and then copied some photographs to it. And one of the lines is that, you know, if you're really going to enjoy the river, you have to embrace the adversity that comes your way. And we had adversity on that trip, as you remember.
Oh, all the way down the line. Remember some of the wind?
Yeah, when we got to Upper Tanner and camped there for 2 nights, I think we had 40 hours of 20-plus mile-an-hour wind,
and
constant.
And some of it was up to 40, 45
right.
mile. It was brutal.
Yeah. And you know, I was trying to pitch my tent and my tent would flap over. And, you know, when I finally got it, my tent squared away, I tried to go to sleep that night. And I realized that it was the small particulate sand was coming through the windows of the tent. And I would wake up and my face was just covered with sand and everything in the tent was covered with sand. And then,
Grand Canyon's way of welcoming
exactly,
Mr. Superintendent.
That's exactly right. And then when you prepared breakfast that next morning, I remember we had eggs and great eggs, but a little gritty because the sand, you couldn't keep the sand out of it.
It was impossible. And I've always prided myself in preparing food without sand. I've gone to great lengths for that, but no, we couldn't even.
Yeah. So we just decided it was roughage.
It was roughage. Oh, you only bite so far.
Yeah.
You know? Well, and you know, they say that probably a big reason that the Anasazi lived such short lives was just that, the sand and the food and the, you know, they'd grind the corn or whatever they were doing. Whatever they were eating, they were eating,
sand.
It's so true. And then we went into the gorge, and you know, having not seen the gorge beforehand, those were remarkable conditions as far as the low water. That must have had some impact on you.
Yes, and I've been attending the Glen Canyon Adaptive Management Working Group meetings, and now in the process of being appointed the Park Service representative to that group, which is interesting because I used to be one of the lawyers to the group.
You do have a good background for this, Ed.
I was joking with Wayne Poulin, who's the Upper Colorado Region Director for Bureau of Reclamation, also one of my former clients, telling him that I was going to be on the river when he was shutting off the water, and would send him some photographs, which I did. And Wayne's a great guy and a lover of the Grand Canyon.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he spent a lot of time here.
That's nice to hear.
At the Grand Canyon. And so it was interesting. You know, we've been talking about our responsibilities to manage the endangered fish, the humpback chub and the razorback sucker, and the impact of water on them and the impact of the levels of water on Lake Powell on those species. So it was great to actually be on the river to watch. I mean, we could literally watch the water drop. I think at night especially.
No, it just drained out.
Yeah.
It really lowered at the down ramp on that was a pretty accelerated down ramp.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting element there in that I did years and years and years of research work, as you know, DCMRC now, but it was the Glen Canyon Environmental Studies, GCS. And it's always been an amazing dance with all the different agencies around this fish where the humpback chub has swum, the dollars have followed in its wake as far as research dollars. And it's an amazing story, the things that we're seeing now with that endangered species. So it's really neat that you do have that perspective as well. And the beat goes on for that. There's a big blow up of humpback chub down in the western end, we're realizing now. And I wonder if it's water temperature or, you know, what the heck is it?
Yeah, there's a lot of variables and we're still studying it.
Yeah, no, it's a really neat story. Those critters of the canyon.
Yeah.
And then, in regards to the park adventures, what else would you like to do as far as your own personal adventures in there? I mean, you must have some hikes in mind or some. I mean, I know I personally have missed a lot because I've been in the canyon on the river. And one of my desires is to spend a lot more time over on the north side and backcountry North Rim and stuff like that. But do you have any targets for the near future as far as Ed's big adventures?
So I'm actually being very intentional about getting out into the park, and I've had a lot of great experiences. So I have this very strong belief that I can't do my job exclusively from my desk. It's a great desk. It's a great office. But in order for me to manage this place effectively, I need to understand it, and I need to be in the place with staff, seeing what their challenges are, helping them identify solutions to their challenges. So I'm carving out time in my calendar to be in the park with staff and learning from them. So I, as a matter of routine, dedicate time to be on the North Rim, including for entire work weeks, right? I have the luxury of having access to a couple of helicopters and a fixed wing plane that I can get around. It's a big park, so I'm able to get around with some aircraft. So I can fly to the North Rim for an afternoon, right? It's a 10-minute flight from the holidays.
No, and that makes
as opposed to a 4-hour drive.
Because there's a lot you need to pack into this,
right? So I do that. When there's a purpose for me to be in the North Rim for a short period of time, I'll take the helicopter. But I'm also calendaring work weeks over there, so I can really understand what the challenges staff have there by being there with them. So I've done that a number of times.
Oh, cool.
And I've been to Tuweep a number of times.
Uh-huh.
Take the fixed wing plane there. And I've gone hiking extensively in the canyon. And every time I'm on the Bright Angel Trail, I stop at Indian Garden and talk to the rangers assigned there. I've overnighted at Phantom Ranch a number of times and spent time with staff there to understand what their challenges are, and just to experience the place.
Yeah.
And one of the things I do is every day I walk to the office. I walk to work, and I walk on the South Rim Trail. And I do that every day because I want to see it every day. I want to be reminded of my responsibilities, and I want to be inspired by it to do my job. So,
what a neat routine that is. That's like yoga or something, in a way.
Yeah,
or
it is.
You know, some sort of.
Yeah, I'll share with you a story. I hiked Nepal. When I lived in Korea, I traveled in Asia, and I hiked a couple of times in Nepal, and there was this one. I was hiking in Gurkha province, and I was over 15,000 feet, and I found this, as we were camping, I found this long rock wall, and so I sat on it, and I looked down into the valley, and I realized I was looking down through the cloud cover into this valley, and I heard a shepherd dog barking from somewhere in the valley, and as this shepherd dog's bark was reaching me on this rock wall at 15,000 plus feet. Wow. I had this idea come to me that I needed to simplify my life. So when I moved from Korea to Washington, I vowed that if I could, one of the ways I would simplify my life is walk to work. I would find a place where I could walk to work. And ever since then, I've had the luxury of being able to walk to work. And so when I lived in Washington, I was able to walk to work. It's just now a very different walk. I'm not walking through the sort of the concrete and glass canyons of Washington, D.C. I'm walking along the Rim Trail of the Grand Canyon.
But there's a lot to that. I can really see that, you know, anybody that has a job and they're getting ready for the new day and stuff, what a sober way to start your day.
Yeah, it's a very good way to gear up for the day, to start thinking about your day. And it's also a great way to wind down because I walk home every night. And,
yeah.
And by the time I get home, I'm ready to be home.
Yeah, yeah, and there, it enables a little bit of separation.
Right.
You live right here, right?
Right, so. Right.
What is the living arrangement here for you? Are you in the superintendent's house? Or?
Yes, the superintendent is assigned housing.
It's
here.
A really cool place, huh?
It's a great house.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to go to a party there years ago, and yeah, that's an elegant place to be.
Yeah, it's a CCC construction.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
So what? Yeah, that would be 30s or something.
Right, and it was designed originally for the chief ranger. Chief law enforcement ranger, The superintendent was supposed to be in what is now Building 1, which is the Zantera headquarters, just down the hill from down the hill from the Alto Var.
Right.
That was the original superintendent's residence. But one of my predecessors didn't like that house and liked, I understand, liked the Chief Ranger's house. So
out goes the Chief Ranger.
He commandeered that house. And it's been the superintendent's residence ever since.
And the Chief Ranger ended up in a tent someplace. And so I am aware that when you came to the park, you did the same thing in the village and stuff. You rode around with the maintenance guys and really have had a hands-on, one-on-one relationship with the staff and stuff. That's a good way of doing business.
Yeah, sure. I told all of my division chiefs that I wanted to, like I said earlier, I want to learn the park. And the only way you can learn the park is by being in the park, being with staff, doing things. So I've worked on a number of science projects with some of Jen's colleagues in science and resource management. I've cleaned toilets. I've done all sorts of things.
Well, that's impressive. That's
and,
great.
It's been a great experience.
And it's probably, like you say, you learn really the nuts and bolts of the place that way instead of looking down on it, really joining it. And
sure. And as I said earlier, one of the things I do is when I'm out in the park, I make notes about who I'm meeting with, what we're talking about, what we're doing. You know, if they've come up with solutions, talk about those and attribute those ideas to the people whose they are, right? I don't try to pretend that other people's ideas are my ideas.
Well, that's huge right there for a leader.
Yeah. And then I write employees, these all-employee emails with, and I take photographs wherever I go. And part of what I'm trying to do is connect people to each other and to the resource. Yeah. And I've gotten great feedback from staff that they enjoy reading my emails and see me interacting with them and being one of them rather than being over them.
Well, I have to admit that I've seen a couple of your emails that Jen has shared with me, and you're a good writer, for one. You're really entertaining. But she feels that way, you know, that it's, and it really it gives ownership to everybody, doesn't it?
Right.
When you credit them for their ideas and jobs,
right,
and stuff like,
right,
that. That's admirable.
It's a way to not only just give credit, but to reward them for their hard work, but also to encourage them to do more, right? I mean,
yeah,
when the superintendent writes an email to all employees and your name is there with telling them what you're telling your colleagues what you're doing and solutions you're coming up to problems, I hope it's empowering.
Oh, I think so. I mean, actually, I think I'm learning from just that, like how I will try and improve how I run my business. You know, it's just a ski shop. Mm-hmm. But I think I could do more of that to empower and, you know, to give ownership of the operation to the people that run it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we're...
That's very good.
Yeah, we're very much a team here. And I'm a member of the team. I'm not even sure I'm the most important member of the team because we all have such an integral responsibility
and role. Yeah, I'd imagine you're up there though.
Yeah.
Now I think we're I don't want to jump into any ambitious things that you don't want to talk about, but in regards to ambition for the park, can you share with us any key things? I mean, I know you've got this huge pipeline project going on, and just so long as you're comfortable with sharing some of the big projects that you've got going on, that would be, I think, really interesting.
Sure. I'll identify a few things that I think people might be interested in just to know about. So one is, when I came to the park, I was surprised that we don't have a hydrologist, and we don't have a geologist, and we don't have a museum curator. And as I explored why we don't have that, I came to find out that for various reasons we don't need to go into, the park had made some decisions that wound up effectively underfunding science. And particularly as I engage in Colorado River Basin issues and, you know, protection of the humpback chub and the razorback sucker, I realize that I need to make decisions and I need to make recommendations to decision makers on the basin mm-hmm. that are grounded in sound science, right? The best available science. One of my roles in the solicitor's office was to be the lawyer to the deputy secretary in his capacity or her capacity as a protector of scientific integrity. I helped design the process, the scientific integrity process in the department. The Department of the Interior was the first cabinet level agency to have a scientific integrity process. And so I came here with a bias to valuing science and making sure that I had the best available science to me as a decision maker and as somebody who recommends to decision makers. So we're working very carefully to increase funding for science here at the Grand Canyon. Another priority, you talked about the Trans Canyon Water Pipeline. It's a $110 to $120 million construction project we replace a system that was designed in the 1960s, built in the early 1970s for a presumed population of 2 million visitors, and it had a shelf life of 25 years. And now, 55 years later?
Yeah, they're putting Band-Aids on it.
With a visitor population pre-pandemic of 6.4 million visitors, the system is breaking down, and we are putting Band-Aids on it repeatedly. The pipes break. They were constructed of tin, I think. Aluminum? Anyway, some metal that you wouldn't expect. I should know the answer to that. And so we're in the design phase, the end of the design phase. We're about to become active in the construction phase in the next several months. In addition to replacing the water line, we're replacing the entire sewage system throughout the park. This winter, we'll be addressing in a temporary fix the problems we have at Phantom Ranch that have constrained our visitors to 50% capacity at Phantom Ranch for the last year. So we hope to increase capacity at Phantom Ranch with a temporary fix, and then we've got a permanent fix there. But we're replacing the sewage systems in the North Rim and the South Rim Historic Village and residences all the way to Desert View.
Oh, wow. So that's just massive.
Right. And as we're looking at these projects, one of the sort of forward leaning ideas is to totally replace the infrastructure on the North Rim. That we close the hotel accommodations on the North Rim every October 15th and don't open them until May 15th for weather related reasons historically. And with climate change, we've seen that the weather has been less of a factor in the North Rim, right? So that's creating an opportunity for us to think about what the future of the North Rim might look like.
Interesting.
And so we're exploring that idea, and you know, we're not in a position to make any commitments at this point. But you know, we're spending money to bury pipelines, to fix the sewage system, to fix the water lines up there, to amongst other things, winterize them so that we can control our own destiny on what the North Rim ought to look like and how we ought to be managing the North Rim for winter operations. So we're trying to work through a decision-making process about that. So I haven't made any decisions about that, but I am working very carefully to preserve space for decisions on what the North Rim operations ought to look like.
Yeah, that really makes sense because, you know, you look at the last 5 years and it's just unbelievable the drought conditions that we've had, that it would leave great opportunity for visitation through months that we never had those months because it would snow in, you know, and stay that way. So
right.
It's sensible.
Another issue that we're looking at is wilderness. This park has been proposed wilderness for 20 7 years. You know, under park policy, we treat proposed wilderness as designated wilderness. Designated wilderness requires a congressional designation. So an act of Congress to designate something wilderness. And there are reasons why we didn't get past the proposed stage. I'm taking a look at those reasons and trying to figure out, you know, is there value in working towards a congressional designation of wilderness? And if so, what should we be doing about that? So right now we're just in the inquiry phase of deciding to fish or cut bait on that question.
Yeah, there's some interesting dynamics to this park in regards, in my mind anyway, to designate a full blanket designation wilderness, you know, because you do have the South Rim, you do have the river travel, and then you've got the North Rim, but
right.
Well, most of it seems like it should be wilderness.
Yeah, you know? Well, the Wilderness Act allows you to designate certain portions of the park as not covered by the wilderness designation.
Oh, is that right?
So yeah, the developed areas in the North and the South Rim, the corridor and the river, are under the current proposal carved out. The colloquial phrase in the business is cherry stemmed.
Oh, okay.
So we're really talking about backcountry and some of our forested areas in the North Rim.
Tremendously massive amount of land that has nothing to do with.
Yeah, over 1 million acres.
Yeah. Yeah, that's big.
And, you know, I'll just share one last initiative that we're working on. I quickly realized as superintendent last year that this park has had troubled relationships with our tribal neighbors. You know, we established the park, we, the federal government, by forcibly removing the people who lived here from time immemorial, and did so without any regard to what it meant to them culturally or spiritually. Mm-hmm. And indigenous people generally, and it's certainly true of the tribes that are associated with the Grand Canyon, have a different relationship to land than those of us who come from a sort of a European Western perspective on land ownership, right? So as the superintendent of the Grand Canyon, I'm responsible for managing this place because Congress has established certain legal responsibilities for the federal government to run this place in an ownership context. But for our tribal neighbors, they don't own the Grand Canyon. They didn't own the canyon, and they don't own it. Rather, the Grand Canyon is a living entity that is part of their spiritual makeup, and their connection to it is different than anything that any of us grew up in a Western-based perspective have to it, or it's part of who they are. We were on the river with Octavia Suatawa from the Zuni tribe, doing Zuni cultural archaeological monitoring. I spent some time with Octavius and got from him, and I'd heard from others that even though Zuni's reservation is in New Mexico, that, you know, when they are thinking of the Grand Canyon, praying, that they are actually at the Grand Canyon, right? Their connection to it is that strong.
Yeah.
And so because of the way the Park Service has, you know, forced people off the land and then managed the place in a way that has both actively and passively kept them away from the land, we've effectively, in many ways, severed them from that. And I believe it's fed into the poverty that we see in much of Indian country around here, and now a growing cultural poverty where it's increasingly difficult, I think, for tribal leaders to impart their values without having the physical access to the Grand Canyon. So I've spent some time last year developing, and now I'm sort of refining and working with departmental leaders and Park Service leaders to finalize a strategic plan that will reframe how the park manages the park and interacts with our tribal neighbors in the management of the park. So I want to be much more welcoming of our tribal neighbors into the park generally and into the management opportunities of the park. And so we're working through the details of that, and I think it's really exciting. I don't know if you and your listeners are aware of the work that's been going on at Desert View, but that's a really interesting opportunity to create indigenous voice interpretation.
Yeah, that is cool.
Economic opportunities through the selling of arts and crafts. I have been working with staff to very consciously extend the Desert View vision, right? We've been working with the Intertribal Working Group that the park established a number of years ago to create that Desert View vision for Desert View. And now we're working in the park to extend the Desert View vision throughout the whole park, starting at the Tusayan Ruins and Museum, 3/10 of a mile west of Desert View, coming into the historic village. We're in the process of renaming Indian Garden to Havasupai Gardens, working with the tribe and tribal members to reinterpret Indian Garden to be honest and respectful of the historical connection that the Havasupai tribe have to that place in the canyon, and even the history of the Park Service forcibly evicting people from that place. We're working with the Grand Canyon Trust to establish a coherent curriculum for indigenous voice interpretation of the river corridor.
Oh, that's
including
really cool.
Bringing in the river operators and river guides into that discussion. That's a process that the trust has undertaken, and I've gotten the park engaged in that process.
Yeah, that's a great partnership there with the trust. And, you know, if you really look at, or having grown up with Navajos and Hopis, and they didn't have personal ownership. And it's such an abstract thing to have borders and fences in their history. So that's really noble work there on your part.
You know, it's interesting. The point you just made about ownerships, they don't have addresses. Many tribal members don't have addresses on Indian reservations.
Yeah.
And so it's impaired their ability to apply for jobs on USA Jobs, for jobs in the park, because one of the requirements is to give an address, and you know, so you add that to the rural broadband issue and internet accessibility, and you know, even access to equipment that many people don't have, you know, computers and so we're working with some innovative ideas to expedite hiring processes for tribal members.
To where Second Mesa is all they need. I'm from Second Mesa.
Maybe not even that.
Uh-huh.
I'm a member of the Navajo tribe.
Oh, wow. Well, that is great emphasis there, because there's, you know, through the years, when you really start realizing what their beliefs are, it's pretty much across the, it's not just Grand Canyon, it's all the land in between them and the Grand Canyon included. Everything's included, and their reverence for the earth is pretty hard to argue with the way they see things.
Right.
It's a beautiful thing.
Right.
Good work.
Yeah,
one
of the other things we're looking at is technical ecological knowledge. So there is a, you know, traditional indigenous perspectives on environmentalism. You know, how to actually steward the land. You know, Park Service has for years developed its approach to scientific research from a Western-based perspective, and sometimes indigenous perspectives are interesting and valuable. So, one of the pieces of this strategic plan is trying to understand better technical ecological knowledge and figure out how to integrate that into our decision-making processes.
Yeah, no, that's really valuable to hear. It's tricky because there's so abstractly different conceptually a lot of it, and you've really got to slow down and to learn what they're thinking and their approaches. I guess a good example, Ed, would be how they grow corn and there's no water and it's in the middle of the desert, right? I mean,
right.
They do some impossible stuff.
Yeah, that's a really interesting notion. So as we look at the opportunities for indigenous voice interpretation at Tusayan Ruins. Tusayan Ruins, I don't know if you're familiar with that area, but there's a 1,000-year-old, 1,200-year-old ancestral Pueblan ruins there. And it used to be well-gardened. I mean, there used to be cornfields there. So we've been talking to some people who are interested in working with us on this project, and one of the observations is it would be great to use indigenous knowledge to grow corn there again as a demonstration project.
As an active project. That really is cool. And, you know, that's an awesome area over there.
Yeah, it really
is. It's plenty of space for you to have to develop that in that direction. I think it's really cool.
Yeah, yeah. People think of the Grand Canyon as, you know, this amazing natural wonder, but there's even more to it than that, right? I mean, we have this great ancestral Pueblan community that lived here 1,000 years ago on the South Rim, and we have their ruins, and it's just a wonderful place to learn about life here 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, the history of this place is so interesting, whether it's geology or human history. I mean, there's a lot more to the big old hole over there than you would look at. You know, this has been such a nice visit. I would ask you for, like, so I don't eat up all your time this beautiful day, but are we going to be all right environmentally? Let's look at it outside the Grand Canyon. And, you know, like you say, you love the outdoors. I know I do. And there's a lot of encroachment on the wilderness footprint, let's call it. And, you know, I worry about these projects that are brought up, like having a gondola on the confluence area, or even if it's infrastructure type stuff with the lakes up Little Colorado. And outside the Grand Canyon, we all don't have a lot of power to fight things and stuff. And I'm just curious as to, what's your optimism here as far as a society in the broader sense in saving this place, this planet?
I was just sharing with my staff that I am relentlessly optimistic by nature. And on this question, I'm optimistic, and I'm optimistic for some what I think are some good reasons. You know, I've mentioned a couple of times my work on the Kala River Basin, and you know, there are obviously climate change related challenges being brought to bear. You see the lake levels of Powell and Meade drop.
Yeah.
And one of the great aspects of the working group is that we have decades of history of people with different interests collaborating to make decisions on a broader landscape that are for the best of everyone. And everybody has a history of compromising. You know, as the situation gets increasingly dire, it's harder and harder for people to make decisions to compromise. But we've got that 30 plus years of history that we can draw on. And everybody in those discussions, whatever their personal interests are, understands that we all have to survive together. So it's a great example of how we're all in this together. And that's the way you solve problems, by identifying common interests, common needs, and leveraging that to make hard decisions. And another reason that I'm optimistic is because there are so many people who love the Grand Canyon, members of Congress, or people who advocate before members of Congress or the administration. And even though they don't always share the same exact policy views, there's this passion about the Grand Canyon that harnesses people's best selves. And yeah, part of my job as superintendent is to harness that goodwill, that the love of this place toward making sound policy decisions So certainly to the extent that I have the authority to make decisions, I've got that perspective. But as other people have influences over decisions or authorities over decisions, part of my job is to help marshal those interests, that passion for the Grand Canyon, to help inform good decision making.
That's remarkably well put. And you know, the Grand Canyon, that's about people, and it's like it wouldn't be as grand if it wasn't observed, you know, type thing. And I salute your outlook on things, Ed, and I thank you so much for sitting in with me.
It's been a pleasure.
And
not as fun as being on the river with you.
No, and so let's do that again. I'll take you on your first dory trip.
Yeah, that time. Sounds great.
But this has been Big Adventures with Ed and Brian. And we're sure glad you guys sat in to share Ed with us. And keep right side up and take care of yourselves. And get that third shot if you're old enough to.
Big Adventures with Brian Durker is supported by Dave Wegner and dedicated to all the scientists and river community who have worked to protect the Colorado River, Grand Canyon, and its environment. Thank you, Dave, for your support of Big Adventures. Big Adventures is produced by Brian Durker, Margaret Knight, and me, Gavin Bugner. Bill Gleckler and his mandolin provide our music. If you like our show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.